If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me.
And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt
I love this land.
This land,
God bless the USA.
God bless the USA.
Dan Happel in Connecting the Dots. Good morning, Dan. How are you doing?
Well, good morning, Thumper. We've got another great program today, and we've got another chance to talk with our special guest, Petrea Patrick. We're going to be showing the film The Titanic, A Perfect Crime, and we're going to be talking about that movie, and we're going to be talking about some other things as well. I'm looking forward to this conversation again. Petrea did a fabulous job for us on Sunday on the Connecting the Dots show. We covered the Black Start movie, which was really, really an eye-opener, and I think she's probably gotten a pretty good idea of some of the support we've got. I hope. I think there were quite a few people that were contacting me that were very interested in her movie. And so hopefully this is going to be the first step in a long line of actions that will really help to bring this subject forward. Now we're going to talk about something totally different. We're going to be talking about the Titanic, the sinking of the Titanic, supposedly after hitting an iceberg. And Petrea has done a fabulous movie. This was actually the first one I saw of her movies about a year ago, and I was just astounded how well everything was done. So Petrea, thank you for joining us. I look forward to this conversation. I want to ask you, and I should give a little bit of background on you. You are the creator of Heartfelt Films. You are a Hollywood brat, as you put yourself, and you started out doing editing and film work in the production end of it, and you decided you wanted to start directing and producing your own movies. And and since then, you've done a number of different movies. You've had very, very high praise for the stuff you've done, and you've also written two books, and we're going to be talking about the book, but also the movie that you did as a project called Titanic, the A Perfect Crime. And so that's what we're heading into today. Thumper, I think we've got that film ready to go, but I want to ask Petrea, first of all, to kind of explain why she got started on this project, what led her to this, and exactly what kind of findings she discovered when she started really delving into this subject. Petrea, thank you. Welcome, and thank you for joining us.
And welcome back to Patriot Soapbox, Petrea.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning. Well, I have to say, what we're going to be talking about is a fascinating subject, and I was looking at the Federal Reserve, and I was studying that, how that came about, and the people behind it. And of course, I became fascinated with the story of J.P. Morgan and how he appeared in that story. So I started doing a lot of research on him, and I found that he actually was the owner of the White Star Line. He had really loved ships, and he went over to Ireland and went to Harland and Wolff and decided that he would like to build these three ships, which would be just opulent, extravagant, and for the very high clientele, and they would be like floating hotels. And once I started realizing, okay, this is the man who owns that, and rarely does anyone think or associate J.P. Morgan with Titanic or with the White Star Line. And so as I began to delve into it, I found so many, intriguing facts that just didn't make sense with the normal story that we'd heard. So I kept researching, and I ended up finding so many interesting facts that I thought, well, this would make a great story. And I thought, people, don't take my word for it, but you can at least see what I've done and what I've deciphered and see for yourself. And then I think it'll intrigue you to go and, perhaps dig farther and perhaps to see a whole different viewpoint than what we've been told in history. Because as we know, history could be told by usually the winners. we get that one side. And certainly with J.P. Morgan owning the newspapers at the time, the story that came out and was widely accepted was that Titanic had been sunk by an iceberg. But right. I'll tell you, I found that J.P. Morgan was a very brilliant man, very brilliant businessman. And as a matter of fact, that Monopoly game is really sort of based on Morgan owning everything and monopolizing everything. So that was one of the things that he wanted to monopolize was the shipping lines. He was going over to Europe with the intent to pick up the Italian line. And so he started with the White Star Line was the first line, and he was looking at picking up the other ones. And then World War One came, so that sort of stopped his plan. And also when Titanic sunk, it really put a big kink in his plans. But let's look at him as the brilliant things that he did. I might not respect what he did, but I think we need to, at least for me, I wanted to understand what his mind was thinking, how he was coming up with these different plans and how they all fit together. It was pretty fascinating. And that led to my second book, which is called 10 Days at Jekyll Island, where again, J.P. Morgan was he was the very backbone, but he didn't want it known. Again, he stays out of the limelight on these things. And so he actually put together the meeting, the secret meeting on Jekyll Island.
Well, isn't that how he owned the estate at Jekyll Island? That's how it ended up being there, is that was one of his numerous estates around the country. Petraea, let's go ahead and show the film, and then we can really get into some of the details. But what you're describing is what many of us have discovered over the years, is that things are never quite as they seem, because you're right. The winners write the history, and they write it the way they want it to be seen. So, Thumper, are we ready to show the movie?
Great. I'll be ready here in just a moment. I have to wait until I actually start to share before I can frame the picture here. So
okay,
bear with me just a moment.
All right. Well, and, we'll just say that J.P. Morgan, Petraea, you're absolutely right. J.P. Morgan was a brilliant man, but he was also an incredibly corrupt man. And all I can say is that this is a really good indication of what we have today, corruption at so many different levels. And he's kind of the guy that started a lot of it, at least not started it. He was one of the people that really exemplified what it's like when you let very, very wealthy, powerful people control everything that they're doing. So, okay, I think we're ready to roll.
All right, here we go. Popcorn at the ready. Here we go.
good seafaring tale the teller embellishes.
All right, let's start from the beginning.
In any good seafaring tale, the teller embellishes and exaggerates to give you their point of view. Titanic needs no exaggeration. Even the official story is full of holes. The first tale of the sea we hear about Titanic is that she sank in one piece. Another tale was that her hull was weak and caused her to sink. Another tale was that there was a fire in a coal bunker. Another tale was that Titanic would race through an iceberg field to make record time. Why would Captain Smith risk racing through an ice field for record time? Time against what? Time against his own ships? Cunard was already known to be a faster line. The White Star Line was built as a luxury line. Why didn't Titanic go south, avoid the ice field? Why didn't Titanic break at the expansion joint? This would be the logical place for her to break in two. Yet we see the expansion joint is in perfect condition. Lawrence Beasley, a science teacher and a credible witness and survivor of Titanic, said Titanic had a list to port exactly like that of Olympic. There was an Italian on deck, and he claims he saw another ship lurking in the vicinity. And he said he never saw an iceberg. Who gave orders to Carpathia to only pick up the survivors and then quickly rush off, leaving the bodies there? And when the Mackie Bennett came and picked up the bodies, it was noticeable that they were cut and bruised, evidence of an explosion. Most passengers would have died from the freezing water. There is no reason for them to be cut and bruised. Did Ismay order Carpathia away so that they would not see the bruised and cut bodies? One sailor at the retrieval of the bodies found a piece of the grand staircase in jagged chunks. And he said, "This looks like it must have exploded." He hid it underneath his jacket and kept it for years. What could set off a big enough explosion to tear her from hull to hull, the entire width of the ship? Now that's huge. How could Titanic have sustained so much damage? Among the passenger list who did not survive was John Jacob Astor, Guggenheim, and Strauss, the three richest men in the world. For these men to not be able to get in a lifeboat begs question. They would be first to be offered a seat. And there's no record that they gave their seat to women or to children. How come the other 58 first-class men didn't give up their seats, if that was the theory? The notorious banking titan, J.P. Morgan, was supposed to board Titanic. Morgan canceled at the last minute, claiming ill health. Yet, he was seen perfectly well with his mistress in France on the very day. Several other prominent figures, Morgan associates, canceled as well. Was Morgan involved in the sinking of Titanic? The truth depends on who's telling the story. If this is the only time we have together, then we shall not be able to hear the whole story of Titanic. As we look again with renewed curiosity, come to your own conclusions about what happened to Titanic, and I encourage you to do so. Her legend captivated our hearts and touched the soul. Shakespeare said, "All the world is a stage." So have we been led to believe what we see in the movies? That's the paradigm, the model we had. We have heard the his story theories, but still leave us with unanswered questions. What really happened? Was a great crime afoot? Titanic has much to tell from her ominous grave beneath the sea. In the serenity of the telling is a story that unfolds of a perfect crime. One cold night, a shipman said something very eerie on his deathbed. Titanic did not sink. A and then there were surviving passengers that support that Titanic did not sink. A few of the crew that jumped ship at Queenstown saw something in the hull that made them abandon ship, even though it meant no work and not feeding their kids. Solomon said, "And with all thy getting, get understanding." Hiding information like this makes us want to know even more. Was it Smith's record of continual accidents that nearly bankrupted the White Star Line? His popularity and celebrity gave the impression of a trusted captain. Yet, Captain Smith himself had many plights, unknown to anyone who did not have access to British naval records. The expanded accounts on his numerous collisions, even before his string of wrecks with Titanic's twin sister Olympic, was quite telling. And Captain Smith had crashed the RMS Olympic severely, leaving Olympic to be declared a wreck. How could Smith be let anywhere near the twin sister Titanic? Why did Titanic have only a half a day sea trial in shallow water? Why did the official record read Titanic went down in one piece? Why were the women survivors who said they saw the ship break in two told they were in shock and that they must have been mistaken? Why was the surviving crew taken to an empty building and threatened with a 20-year prison sentence under the Official Secrets Act to never speak of the sinking? Why, if there was nothing to hide? When Titanic was built, she had evenly spaced portholes. When she left Southampton, she had unevenly spaced portholes. The wreck found 2 miles below sea has unevenly spaced portholes. Why did they carpet the exquisite tile floors of the a la carte restaurant on Titanic if they were new? You would not go to the expense to lay intricate, expensive floors and then cover them with the carpet. Was the carpet to hide wear of a floor that would show scuffs and scratches? Was it to hide the fact that it was not a new ship? The last minute expense to carpet floors and a few cosmetic changes up on the bridge when the White Star Line was facing potential bankruptcy. It all leaves a strange question in our minds. Was this a new ship? Einstein said, "The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant." Our intuition asks us to question preconceived notions. Our intuition lets us know something's not right. And the faithful or rational mind says, don't ask questions and don't rock the boat. Today we are going to rock the entire fleet of the White Star Line. What I'm going to share with you took digging and thinking and researching. Some of the fascinating things that I've questioned about Titanic will connect the dots. There are many stories from the survivors that put together a different picture of what happened to this beautiful liner. But it is the man who owned the White Star Line that is of interest because of the secrets he held close to his chest. Who was the man who owned the White Star Line? The story of Titanic is the story of a man, a mastermind, creating monopolies beyond the dreams of the common man. He was known for keeping competitors locked in his museum for days, or held captive on his estate on Jekyll Island until the deal he wanted was struck, or out at sea on his yacht, never anchoring till they agreed to his schemes. And one of his purchases was the White Star Line. Once upon a time, on an overcast morning in Belfast, Ireland, in 1907, a silver ghost Rolls-Royce pulled up to the offices of Harland & Wolff. Cigar smoke billowed out as the chauffeur opened the door, and the huge figure appeared in his top hat and overcoat. This was the famous J.P. Morgan. He was a bigger-than-life character. The handle of his crystal walking stick glistened even in the dull sky. He caught the eyes of the workers at Harlan and Wolf. His bulbous nose was ugly. He had a bad case of rosacea, which made it look huge and bumpy. He was known to intimidate people with it because they could not bear to look at him. But most of the time, inwardly, he was devastated with the grotesque appearance. He would never let any photographers get shots of him. Any photo he had control of, he had retouched. On some photos and paintings, he even had hair painted in. His son Jack, a younger version of himself, followed, and they headed into the offices of Harlan and Wolf. Bruce's man, Lord Perry, received them. Morgan proceeded to puff his cigar. He seemed always encircled in a cloud of smoke. He was there to buy the White Star line. But Ismay wasn't on par with the likes of Morgan. Ismay stood firm that the White Star line was not for sale. Morgan had inside information that the White Star line was on the brink of bankruptcy, and he knew there were many out of work. Ismay was pushing his best pompous attitude, and he replied that an American was not even allowed to own a British line. Morgan, however, did not want it known that he owned it. He knew his merchant marine company would purchase the White Star line, and no one would be the wiser. In fact, Morgan was looking at buying up the Italian shipping lines next to gain the monopoly on the European shipping lines. Neither Ismay nor Lord Perry wanted to sell to the likes of this monopolist. But Morgan boasted that he could save it, and it would put the city back to work. Big money in their pockets. So Morgan became the owner of the White Star Line. It was Morgan's dream to build luxurious floating hotels, the largest ever to be built. Olympic, Britannic, and Titanic. He wasn't going for speed, but for elegance and opulence. Let the Cunard Line go for speed, Morgan thought. We shall gain the vacationing crowd with money and make plenty on the bar and steerage. Morgan wanted Ismay to stay and run the White Star Line. And so the largest dock ever was commissioned to house the bulk of these huge ships. Olympic's keel was laid. Morgan brought new energy. The shipmen cherished the work. They had been through tough times with the stifled White Star. They were glad for the wages and proud to be working on the greatest ship in the world. And so Olympic was the first off the line. Captain Smith was to take the helm. He was known as the millionaire's captain. Olympic was launched on October 20, 1910, without having been christened beforehand. Now, Morgan loved ships. He had the largest collection of luxurious yachts, each one built just for him, each one larger and more pretentious than the others. He would do much of his business on the yacht. And the yachts were also a private place where he took his mistresses. And although he kept the affairs somewhat discreet from his home life, York society was littered with ex-Morgan mistresses. They forgot the grotesque nose and focused on twinkling diamonds and the beautiful estates he lavished them with. And he made sure his endless string of women were set for life when he was done with them. The decks of his yacht, his floating world, was where he lived, and in his mind, there were no laws at sea, so he did whatever he wanted, whatever furthered his empire. And Morgan had just finished his huge breakfast out on the exterior deck salon, and he lit a cigar. And Jack came in with a telegram stating that Olympic had been in an accident. Morgan couldn't believe it. This was Olympic's maiden voyage. What was he hearing? But arriving on the docks in the New York Harbor, Olympic's propeller drew a tugboat into her, and the tugboat was destroyed. Morgan cursed as he pulled the cigar from his lips. These huge propellers on Olympic were a new triple-blade design, and they would suck smaller boats into them. So we see Captain Smith's first accident with Olympic. Now, Morgan did not want to soil the reputation of his new ships, so he quickly paid a huge sum to keep the matter quiet. But it was the next news that Morgan received that took the wind out of his sails. Morgan watched as Jack ran a newsreel on his projector. This time, Olympic's plight couldn't be hidden. Film showed Olympic with a giant gash. The HMS Hawk and Olympic had collided, and the Hawk was a warship with an underwater ram designed to sink other ships, and it opened the starboard stern side of Olympic's hull. It did some underwater damage as well, the extent of which had not yet been examined. The film ran out of the projector, and Morgan sat there, a silhouette in the projector light, his bulbous nose in a foreboding shadow. Even Jack had to cringe. With all Morgan's power, there was no way he could keep this from the press. It was already in a newsreel. So now, a second accident for Captain Smith. You would have thought that Morgan would have fired him after the maiden voyage accident. And then Jack gave Morgan the bad news. British Naval Inquiry charged that Olympic was at fault, and Morgan would have to pay all the damages to the British Navy. And on top of that, he had to put up all his Olympic passengers in hotels and pay their fare on other ships to their destination. Morgan fumed as his thick brows crunched over his black eyes. He poured himself an 80-year-old scotch. And now Morgan was angry. Revenge filled his thoughts and his veins, where blood should have run. Ideas formed in his head. These men were not going to get one over on him. He'd get them one way or another. Smoke billowed out from his lips until he was surrounded in a huge cloud. The ash on his cigar grew long. Without Olympic running and Titanic unfinished in the docks, Morgan's grand plan to build these three floating hotels was crumbling, and he moved closer to bankruptcy. And more bad news came. Andrews, the White Star Line designer, announced that she was hit to the keel, and that she had a list to port, and that the Hawk's ram had reeled the death blow. Her damage under the waterline penetrated to the keel, and any shipman knows if the keel is destroyed, the ship is destroyed. This was a huge sum of money that Morgan faced losing. He insisted she be fixed, but how could Andrews get across to Morgan that she was not seaworthy, she was done for, that it would cost more to repair Olympic than to build a new one? Pulling a ship down to its keel to make repairs was just not affordable. He pled with Morgan, as much as any man could. He explained you'd have to tear her in half and take the engines and the boilers and the turbines out just to get to the keel. And you'd have to build a new keel and then a new hull. It just wasn't worth it. But Morgan couldn't think of anything to do. For days he drank and he smoked, and then slowly an idea came. Morgan's plan was to patch up Olympic. The hull was an easy fix, only rivets and paint. She looked great above the waterline. Then Captain Smith took her out to Sandy Hook off the coast of New York and ran over a sunken wreck. Olympic's propeller was completely destroyed. The accident had caught Olympic's propeller in the sunken ship, and Olympic's propeller dragged along the wreck, causing extensive damage. Another accident. This is the third wreck that Olympic is in with Captain Smith at the helm. Olympic had to be towed all the way back across the sea to the docks. So does Morgan fire Smith? No. So what was going on? What was afoot? Was Smith trying to get the insurance for Morgan? Or is Smith just that daft? Now Olympic's propeller is destroyed and left for scrap metal. Claiming the insurance on Olympic was the only thing that would put him back into the green. Morgan filed the insurance claim, hoping they wouldn't notice that the keel damage was really from the Hawk accident. But to Morgan's surprise, it really didn't matter, because they turned his claim down, saying that the sunken wreck was charted on the maps. Now Morgan was in a huge financial bind. Titanic was not yet off the dock, and Olympic was not bringing in passengers. Not even seaworthy. And Morgan was overextended. He had not yet pulled off his cartel, the Federal Reserve System, so money was not flowing in from there. And he had to pay off his numerous yachts. Those were the largest and most expensive ever built at the time. And Morgan had his string of mistresses, which was an endless drain on his money supply. Then there was the Morgan Museum. He filled it with the collections that would not fit in his house. All his rare jewels and statues and his priceless books and priceless historic letters that he continually collected. And he had a huge estate by the coast and his Madison Avenue mansion and his estate on Jekyll Island. And he bought the steel company and it all cost. So if Olympic did not make good, the White Star Line was facing bankruptcy. Jack had warned him not to buy a staggering line. Morgan must have had another plan for this ship that was declared a wreck. We know Morgan's plan did not involve tearing Olympic in two and rehauling her from the keel up, for there are no records of this occurring. Titanic was still months away from being ready. As the twin ships were docked side by side, Morgan ordered the propeller number 401 from Titanic to be put on Olympic and replace the destroyed build number 400 that was Olympic's number. The order to switch Titanic's propellers to Olympic is logged in Harlan and Wolff's records. The build number is key so they know which ship it goes on. So now Titanic's propeller build number 401 is on Olympic. And as well, orders were given to put bracing struts on Olympic's keel. Now why put a new costly propeller and costly bracing struts on a ship that is declared a wreck? So what was going on? It seemed sketchy sending out a ship that had been declared a wreck. Harlan and Wolff has accurate logging of the hole in Olympic's hull on the starboard side stern being fixed. They also have accurate records of the bracing struts added on Olympic's keel. There is also an accurate accounting of Titanic's propellers being switched to Olympic. Yet, all of a sudden after that, Olympic's records are missing for quite a long period. This is suspicious. You would never lose records on a ship that has been declared a wreck, especially if she is known to be on the high seas with bracing struts and a list to port. This is unheard of. For Harlan and Wolff to have lost those records on Olympic at that time leads one to believe dastardly deeds were afoot. Captain Lord was called to Morgan's yacht for a meeting. Lord was captain of the Californian through another shipping line that Morgan owned. He stood tall and proud, as he was sure after Captain Smith's despicable accident that Smith would be dismissed and he, Lord, would be asked to captain Titanic, which was now advertised for its April voyage. Lord could hear Morgan's words in his head. Smith is finished. You shall captain Titanic. I wouldn't let that fool near my ships after what he's done to Olympic. Captain Lord stood there, his lips pursed to say yes, but Morgan only toyed with his cigar with a strange look in his eye. And he commenced. Captain Lord, I hear you've saved thousands of passengers from a sinking ship and transferred them all over to your ship in an hour's time without losing a soul. Lord's shoulders broadened and, yes, he said. You could just hear Captain Lord's thoughts. This is fantastic, he's thinking. The commission of a lifetime. But Morgan was in his own thoughts as he sucked on his cigar. Morgan gestured toward the scotch to offer Lord one. As Lord poured, Morgan's words came in an exhale of smoke. He wanted Captain Lord to take the Californian out to sea. Can you imagine? Lord must have been shaken, thinking, what in the heck? Captain Smith just wrecked your prize ship, and now you're going to let him captain the Twin? You're mad! Yet, as he held silent, his disdain creased in his forehead. Why would Morgan be talking to Captain Lord, a captain experienced in saving thousands of lives from a sinking ship? That alone begs question. Morgan must have discussed some other secret information and then dismissed Lord. Now Olympic and Titanic are side by side on the dock. People always got the twins mixed up. It would have been all too tempting for Morgan to switch the ships at this point. All that would be needed would be to switch the nameplates, lifeboat nameplates, the menus, cover the wear on the floors with the carpet, change out the used furniture. It would only take a small crew. And we do know this was all taking place during the coal strike, so the docks would have been empty. It was apparent that Morgan had to figure out how to get enough coal for Titanic's run, Californian, and Olympic. Because of the coal strike, there was no coal to buy. Morgan realized the dilemma, and he had to come up with an idea. His brilliant mind charged in thought. He had his men go around to the stranded dock ships and buy up every bit of coal in their boiler room. Salvaging all of it, there was enough coal to get Titanic, the Californian, and Olympic to sea. This is said to be footage of Titanic. Look at the film closely. You'll see that the identification on the tugboats is scratched out. The obvious reason is because Titanic never made it to New York. Clearly, this is Olympic, and the tugboats were in New York. Therefore, they scratched the names out. Since the ships were twins, pictures of Olympic were often used for Titanic. And there weren't many pictures of Titanic since she had met with her demise early on. People always got the twins mixed up. Now, as Olympic and Titanic sit side by side on the dock, Morgan executes new orders. Remember, Morgan is furious that the British Navy got one over on him, and he wasn't about to lose his investment. Bankruptcy was not an option. This became personal. It's easier to fool people than to have them believe that they have been fooled. Morgan brilliantly laid all the focus on Titanic's maiden voyage as he drew attention away from the trying, disheartening collisions of Olympic's plights. And quietly, Olympic, or the ship now called Olympic, set out to New York on March 7th, far enough away so no one could compare the twins. And meanwhile, Titanic did her sea trials. Maritime law requires sea trials for new ships. And for a ship this size, it would be a 3-day run, seeing it handle in deep water, seeing it handle in the docks. But Titanic only had a 1/2-day trial in shallow water. Why? How could they even get away with that, when the usual requirement was 3 days in deep waters? That did not give the inspector enough time to go down and check the boilers and the engines or the turbines. Titanic spent a month building her excitement for her maiden voyage. 2-page advertisements in newspapers touted the stage and other eminent personalities were to grace their presence on Titanic. And then the Californian left with no passengers, a few doctors, sweaters and blankets, and oddly no cargo. Which is strange because it would have been quite easy to acquire passengers. In a coal strike, only 2 ships were leaving, Titanic and Californian. Who could even afford to send a ship off with no cargo? The Californian left a fortune on the docks by not taking cargo. And Morgan was complaining of not wanting to lose money, yet sends his own ship out empty? It's very suspicious. And again, how in the world could Morgan let Captain Smith take Titanic on a maiden voyage after what he'd done with Olympic? Remember, Smith had an accident with Olympic on her maiden voyage, and then crashed the Hawk, and then ran over the sunken wreck, destroying the propeller. If this was really Titanic, Smith would have been the last person Morgan would have asked to take his new liner on her maiden voyage. He would not have let Smith anywhere near his new ship. Now all the gazing crowd that came to see Titanic off were surely given entertainment. As Smith takes her out of the docks on her maiden voyage, he had run too close and sucked the SS New York off her tether. Smith must have been a nervous wreck. One of the tugboat captains saw the unmanned New York aiming for Titanic. Because of the coal strike, the SS New York had virtually no crew and was not running its engines. And now it was just being sucked into Titanic. Smith could see his career ending in this moment. The tugboat captain yelled an order to lash the SS New York and pull her away. But his tosser's first few throws missed. The New York drew within inches of Titanic. Captain Smith stood frozen, watching it all before his eyes. Can you imagine? People on the docks were gasping. Smith must have been sweating bricks. And the heroic captain, his ship dangerously close, had the tosser throw the line out again. And this time it held, and he yelled, "All full on the engine." This was an incredible feat, and he saved the SS New York from crashing into Titanic's hull with inches to spare, and saving Captain Smith yet another slash on his record. So Smith is in another near miss on Titanic's maiden voyage. What is going on? We just witnessed Smith in 2 incidences on maiden voyages for the White Star Line before he's even to sea. If he's not able to make it out of the harbor, how could you trust him on the high seas? His popularity and celebrity gave the impression of a trusted captain. Yet Smith almost single-handedly was the cause of putting the White Star Line on the edge of bankruptcy. Yet he was asked to take the helm of Titanic, a brand new multi-million dollar liner. He was known as the millionaire's captain. How did he gain that reputation? He saw how other captains waited for commissions for years on the White Star Line. And now he knew he wasn't a great navigator. In fact, Smith did not pass his navigation test the first time. But Smith did have wit. Using New York, where his flights would be little known, he would use his charm and his connections and a social life to move up the ranks for the bigger commissions. His plan was to hobnob at social affairs and get invited to high society events and mingle with the elite to gain his celebrity to advance his position. If his record had been known to the New York crowd, they certainly would have shunned him. Captain Smith's naval record shows as captain who was involved in running the Republic aground, plus killing 3 crew members in a boiler accident on the same day. And in 1890, he ran a ship aground off Rio de Janeiro, and in 1901, aboard the Majestic, and in 1906, aboard the Baltic, Smith was responsible for huge fires on board. And then Smith ran the Adriatic aground. Why would Smith be let anywhere near the twin sister Titanic? So here on Titanic, if there was to be another accident now on the maiden voyage, would the investigations have exposed this would have been Olympic? And why was Captain Smith not able to concentrate and maneuver his ship? Why was he such a nervous wreck? And why would all this not be looked into further? Well, of course, the White Star Line had put everybody under the Secrecy Act, not to speak of the sinking. And certainly, the White Star Line had lost any hopes of being a credible line. The British by now knew they were going to war in the near future, and Morgan knew it too. So he offered to take their gold and shipments to America for safekeeping, away from the possibility of getting into German hands. And there were also rumors of a British military van that arrived with crates marked museum statues and secretly loaded in the early hours of the morning into Titanic's cargo hold in Southampton on April 10th. Morgan was supposed to board in Cherbourg, but at the last minute, he canceled his reservations and had the crates marked museum statues removed. Did he remove these crates because he knew the ship was going down? So Morgan had good reason to sink the ship. For that fortune alone, millions in bullion. And Morgan had an earlier example of how to pull off this crime. Surely he had read about the SS Islander. It was said to have struck an iceberg, sinking with the gold cargo she carried. Did this entice Morgan? Did it give him ideas? And Morgan wasn't the only one to cancel his reservations on Titanic. A few of the crew jumped ship at Queenstown, even though it meant going back to where there was no work. And the White Star Line had enforced the Secrecy Act. It was frightening to be threatened. The White Star Line had even hired bulls who watched for loose lips, even in the pubs. Something that is overlooked is that some of the survivors said Titanic exploded and then broke in a V shape, not that she broke from the weight of the stern. One of the surviving crew drew this picture in his logbook, and the way she was shredded in a V shape lead to evidence of an explosion below in the hull. He hid the drawing and never spoke of it, and years later it surfaced through his family. Now, the Irish were shipbuilders, and there are theories that their riveting of the hull was not a quality job, and somehow that caused Titanic to sink. Somehow that doesn't hold water, since the rivets in Titanic's hull are still holding to this day. And the Irish were fantastic shipbuilders. The idea that a coal fire sank Titanic, well, that's not viable. Titanic exploded in the stern, not the bow area, not where this alleged coal fire would have been. And the stern is where you see evidence of a huge explosion, the hull protruding outward. What could set off a big enough explosion to tear her from hull to hull, the entire width of the ship? Now that's huge. That leads to explosives being set. Both port and starboard have the hull protruding outwards in massive sheets of steel. Notice that the Hawk accident, the steel is protruding inwards into her hull, whereas Titanic's hull is shredding outwards. Compare Titanic's sister ship, Britannic. She served in World War I and was sunk when she hit a floating German mine. If a German floating mine meant to take down a ship, could take Britannic down, and basically we see no damage from port hull to starboard hull, how could Titanic possibly have damage from port hull to starboard hull? And Britannic's was from a mine intended to sink a ship. How could Titanic have sustained so much damage Now, some say an explosion from the boilers caused this massive damage. But if Titanic's boilers could explode Titanic from hull to hull and shred her in two pieces, why didn't Britannic explode when her boilers hit the water? And Britannic is still in one piece from a mine meant to sink a ship. Here are Titanic's boilers on the seafloor. They do not look like they have exploded, nor do her engines. One more of the many things that, when scrutinized, lead to that a switch was on. The way Titanic landed, there is no way to see this supposed 300-foot gash from an iceberg. When Titanic and Olympic were side by side, and the window changes were made and the propeller switched, Morgan could make the choice to pull a switch. Was a switch on? Was Olympic now Titanic? Was an insurance scam in place? These are the portholes of the wreck that was found 2 miles below the sea. They certainly suggest that dastardly deeds were afoot. And how could Morgan know that Smith would go along with this? Well, one reason might be that Morgan knew the Californian was coming and assured Smith no souls would be lost because Lord would save them all. Now, another thing that begs question. Captain Lord was quoted as sleeping in his uniform that night in the chart room. What was he waiting for? And then when Californians saw the white rockets, Captain Lord dismissed them. A box of colored rockets was found near the wreckage of Titanic. Unfired colored rockets. Was Smith asked to fire only white rockets? And was Captain Lord asked to only look for colored rockets? Is that why the colored rockets are on the seafloor? Why did Smith not fire every rocket he had at his disposal? He had time to shoot them all. He had 2 hours and 40 minutes. Why didn't he fire all the rockets? Was his last thought that Morgan had double-crossed him? Morgan did get the insurance, and she did sink in two pieces, even though the official record said one. And many of the first-class women saw the ship break in two. Many of the women complained to Captain Smith that they felt vibrating during the voyage. They had made this trip many times. These were wealthy women who every year vacationed by ship to France, and they knew how a ship should feel. These women were told they must have been in shock and couldn't possibly have seen the ship break in two. They also said they heard explosions. These women were ignored for years. Eva Hart stood by her story that she saw the ship sink in two. Eva was adamant about what she saw, enough so to stand up to the heavy opposition she faced. And when Titanic was found by Ballard in 1985 in two pieces, proving the women were correct, Eva was still alive to relish in her claim that she had the truth. The historic accounts were falsified. Sadly, there were no official apologies, no decency of act attempted to give the women the merit in that what they saw was the official telling. So to pull off this scam, the ship would have to sink. There would have to be no chance that she could limp home like she had done before. So Morgan easily could have had explosives set. Morgan's conscience would be clear because he had the Californians standing by to save the passengers. They would all be transferred to an empty ship with 3,000 sweaters and blankets and brandy. No other cargo, no other passengers. Why would the Californian rush out and just sit there with a captain experienced in saving thousands of lives at sea from a sinking ship? Why didn't the Californian respond? It just does not add up. Was there a change in plan? Did the old adage, loose lips sink ships, come into play? Was it a coincidence the three richest men in the world coming back to vote against the Federal Reserve Money Trust Act all went down with Titanic? What's the connection there with the money trust bill that was formed on Jekyll Island by J.P. Morgan? Since 1985, several different submersible teams found number 401 build number on the propeller. But remember, Titanic's propeller was on Olympic. Now, what do you think? Other submersibles who assessed the hull report that the hull damage is protruding outward as if an explosion from her inside tore the hull outwards. Despite the immense fanfare and hype that surrounded Titanic's launch, it was roughly half full when it left Southampton. Did the White Star Line want to minimize the number of passengers because it intended to scuttle the ship? Or had rumors of the insurance scam spread outside the shipyard? Several last-minute cancellations from those notable passengers certainly suggest some kind of foreknowledge. And years later, there was a man who told his wife on his deathbed that he had changed the nameplates on the twins. For J.P. Morgan, he died very shortly after Titanic's demise. Olympic, meanwhile, went on to serve for another 25 years. The question that lingers in our minds is, how could a ship that's been declared a wreck possibly serve on the high seas, on the transatlantic crossing, being held together with bracing struts that had a list to port and was vibrating, then had to travel so slowly not to seize up the engines? This is another point that does not add up. So was it just magical that her list to port all of a sudden disappeared, that her vibration disappeared, and that she was able to travel at her full speed capacity without the engine seizing up? Given the structural damage on Olympic and the fact that there are no records to show millions of dollars put into her for upkeep and these types of major repairs on a ship that had been declared a wreck, it's impossible to believe that she'd be seaworthy for that many years. No one would have boarded for a transatlantic voyage on a ship that had lost its integrity. Certainly, word would have gotten out not to ever get on that ship. So to think that Olympic served 25 more years is really stretching our imaginations. Why didn't they save Olympic and turn her into a tourist attraction like they did with the Queen Mary? This was the sister of the most famous ship ever. It would have been a moneymaker. Hearing the story of Titanic leads us to ask, what other events in history have false narratives? And many more details and much more of the story awaits you in the pages of Titanic, A Perfect Crime.
Wow, fantastic. Fantastic movie. Patria, your point is well taken. What exactly in history has happened that really has been completely rewritten? And the fact is, I think an awful lot of our history is rewritten. I don't think there's much of our history that hasn't been rewritten. And I can look at events like 9/11 and so many things that have cost so many lives that seem to always end up being, I don't know, put a new light on or covered up. That, you know, the cover-ups are huge. And this is a perfect lead-in for your other book, and that is the 10 Days at Jekyll Island. But let's talk about J.P. Morgan. Let's talk a little bit more about this man.
Well, for me, it was really intriguing to see inside his mind And I think this is the first film that puts together the pieces, the bind that he was in. And if you read his memoirs, you certainly don't see any evidence like this at all. And for many years, I think it was very easy to hide a lot of this information. Morgan did own the newspapers, very powerful man. And if you wanted work, you certainly weren't, and you were in Ireland, you certainly kept your mouth shut. You had kids to feed. And I think of this, listen, first off, I would just love to see people like, you know, do your own research and see what you find. It's not easy, but there's an information out there. And I just feel like Morgan, he had so many things going on. He was trying to buy the steel industry and the railroad lines, and he wanted to do the hotels and then the floating hotels. And he was involved in the Panama Canal deal, which really is interesting. And 10 Days from Jekyll Island gets into some of the other things that he was doing, which really is fascinating, like coming up with the telegraph and supporting that, and energy with Tesla. Mm-hmm. And he was working with Edison. And that's a real interesting story just in itself, why we ended up, you know, more with Edison's patents. And so I feel like, just as a character, you know, I think you want to understand, you know, like in The Art of War, you want to understand your enemy. Mm-hmm. And how they're thinking. And not that Morgan was my enemy, but I just became aware that I would need to understand how he was thinking. And I love the name of your show. It's, you know, you're connecting the dots, and it just became easy to read between the lines when you see the bind that Morgan was in this particular situation. And what was trying to at the same time push this bank cartel. So, and the fear of going bankrupt with his White Star line really would have done him in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he really had to think out of the box. And you can see, if he put that plan together, that's pretty brilliant. And I think he'd need to do something on that scale. So it's pretty fascinating that he would go to these lengths to do know, something like that. And I always thought too that he died shortly after, and I wonder if it wore heavy on him, and perhaps.
Well, you know, Petrea, I think part of the thing that we learn from these very, very powerful, wealthy people is that human life really doesn't have that much value to them unless it's their lives. And just the fact that they would do something like this, knowing full well that there would be a loss of human life. I mean, you wouldn't do this. I wouldn't do this. I'd rather face bankruptcy than even have one life lost as a result of something I did. But that isn't the way these people think. And frankly, that's the reason we're in the situation we're in today. And I know you follow a lot of the news as closely as I do. I think you even mentioned this to me, the Klaus Schwab. And Klaus Schwab just recently announced that the world was going to go through a major, something very major was going to happen, and it would make the pandemic look like a cakewalk, basically. And he had already announced a year ago that we were going to have a great reset that would literally take down the economy of the entire world and put us into a new paradigm where we'd be talking totally digital currency, no way of tracking anything. So these people have a mindset that is diabolical. I mean, there's no other way you could describe it. It's diabolical.
Well, some of them do. And then, you know, just even for the benefit of Morgan, I could say, look, he was in a bind and he had to take care of business. And I don't think he thought, you know, his intention wasn't to do anything other with the ships anyway. You know, he was doing other things in other venues, but with those ships, I don't think he ever planned to do anything but make money off them, and a huge amount of money. But the British Navy certainly didn't want him there. And there's other things. I mean, I would love people to think like, you know, like there's just a lot. Once you start thinking that you can figure out, and people can come up with their own conclusions on what are some of the reasons that he would have done this. But I think, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, what I know somebody is thinking in their mind, and I hate to, you know, try to understand that somebody's evil from the get-go. But one of the things is that you said is very true. Look, some people just are that way. I think one of the things Morgan had going for him at the time was there was no internet. There was no way to get down there and see that ship. There was no technology at the time. So people were just going to pretty much believe the newsreel and the newspaper that he was in charge of. So today is frightening for what you said with Klaus Schwab, because that was heard on the internet. Now, I don't know how many, you know, it's not something somebody would, some people haven't even heard of that gentleman. And you have to kind of go out of your way to even go find what he's saying and that he said that, this Klaus Schwab. But that is horrendous. And I do urge people, we do have the internet today. And there's a lot of things on the internet that aren't true, and you have to scrutinize. However, there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of great shows like yourself and people who have put some great information together. And it's just wonderful that you have your show. And I just urge people, look into these things for yourself. So, you know, don't take my word on it. Hey, I put together a great story, and geez, you know, that's great, but.
Well, you put together some a number of great stories, and that's a part that's impressive to me. And I haven't seen it yet, but I am going to look at American Empire, An Act of Collective Madness. I have not seen that film. I am going to look at it. I see that you have a kind of an endorsement by Oliver Stone that says, this film is a provocative film. It makes you think. Your points are made strongly. I have to commend you on a very well done movie. And that's a quote by Oliver Stone. So we're doing a little plugging for you here while we're doing this, because people, you need to go to her website, heartfeltfilms.net, because she has a site where many of these films are available. And all she really asks is that if you enjoy her films, leave a little bit of a donation to her program, because you have to understand these films cost an awful lot of money to make. And even when you're doing so much of the work yourself, but I can tell, Petrea, this is a labor of love. The reason you do this is because you just want the truth out there. And I know you and I share a mutual admiration, respect for G. Edward Griffin. And in that regard, let's talk about your film about 10 days, or your book, 10 Days at Jekyll Island, because we just had our Red Pill Expo at Jekyll Island, and I stayed with Ed and his wife, Pat. We were right down the hall from one another at the Morgan Resort, which is now part of the hotel system there. And we actually were in the room where the Federal Reserve Act was written. We got a chance to take some pictures of that and spend some time there. Talk a little bit about that 10 days, if you would.
Well, it was fascinating that these gentlemen in the, you know, the dead of winter, it was Thanksgiving, and Morgan chose a select group. that he wanted to go to this meeting, and that they didn't like each other. They were competitors, and they were put, they were told to go to the train, and they went and got on the private rail car. At that time, Senator Aldrich, you know, is very wealthy. He had his own private car, so that would attach to one of the major trains going in and out of stations. So they were told to come one by one, not address each other. And once they even got on the train, they were just to address each other by like first names. A couple of them even made up phony names, and they didn't want anybody to know who they were, not even the servants. And then once they were on the train, they were told, like, you're going, we're, you know, if you agree to come to this meeting, then you're going to, you know, you're going to go, and we'll tell you where we're going. And they didn't, none of them bowed out, because even though being competitors and they hated each other and didn't want to spend time together, they knew if they didn't go, might be left out of it. So what was the secret meeting with these other guys? So they all went, and then they were told, like, hey, now we're going to Jekyll Island. Like, okay, so first off, there weren't cell phones. So the, how are they going to explain this to their wives? Like, I am, you know, gone for 10 days. I can't tell you where. I don't even know where myself, and didn't know how long they were going. But it was unheard of for somebody at that time to leave at Thanksgiving from their families and not explain where they're going. So it's very weird on that respect. And then to go so far, that, why didn't they just have the meeting in a at Morgan's Museum or some convenient place? Well, Morgan didn't want any association. He didn't want it at his museum. He didn't want it close by. He didn't want any chance of reporters getting a whiff that these men were together. So he figured the best place was to send them off 1,000 miles on this train to Jekyll Island. And he had great scotch aboard the train that was taking him there. So I'm pretty sure they were pretty toasted and everything. But when they arrived, but they did, they haggled it out. And even in the defiance of not liking each other and the mistrust, they sat around the table there. And that, you know, that room, it's famous now. It's people, I don't think most people get how famous that is, but we're living in the century of that meeting, of the meeting that took place in that room. We are living under the results of that right now. The claw of that banking cartel, as G. Edward Griffin calls it. And the Federal Reserve that came about out of that meeting, as most of your listeners know, but just to reaffirm, is not part of the government. So calling it federal was just like, they had to come up with a name. Like, so what are we going to call this thing? We can't go, oh, a new cartel bank that rips the people off. So we need a clever name, and it needs to sound like it's part of the government and that it has money. So they ran over a few names, and some of those didn't work that great. And then they finally got the bill passed by calling it the Federal Reserve, which sounded like it was part of the government and sounded like it also had reserves of money. And the fascinating thing, Dan, is for your listeners to realize that at that time, a lot of people, such as Lindbergh, the father of the aviator Lindbergh, his father was a congressman, and I believe later became a senator. And he was very, very well educated in understanding about what was going on with the banks. Why not to have a central bank? There were a lot of people understood we don't want a central bank. From back to Jackson, from back to one of the reasons with the American Revolution, we just didn't want that in our America. We didn't want a bank that we're borrowing money to and owed interest to.
Right.
Wanted the government just, hey, let's just print our own money. We issue it. We don't have to charge our citizens any interest on it. So there's no debt. But that's where J.P. Morgan was like, look, if we can get that bank, then we can charge that interest and we'll have a printing press. And so I thought this is how I came about all this. So you just think about Morgan and his competitors at the time. Rockefeller was into the oil, and then you had Ford, who's into, you know, manufacturing this car industry with the Model T and the railroad lines. His competitors, the Rockefellers and such, were fantastically wealthy. But the difference between Morgan is like, okay, if I have these oil wells, I have to go out and spend a lot of money to figure out, okay, I have to buy so many oil wells and so many won't come through. Then I have to process the oil. I have to transport the oil. I have to sell the oil. It's a cost a lot of money. Same thing with the other industries, the steel industries or the Model T. You know, you have to have all these workers. You have to buy this, all the things that you need to manufacture your car. So it's costing. But Morgan's plan was, I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is just put this bank in here and I will have a money printing press machine and be set.
Every dollar is based on debt and it's completely created out of nothing. And that is a brilliant plan. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. So he, to me, he out-brillianced all his competitors just with that. And you have to give him credit for it. I don't like that we're living in that, but that's back again to understanding. If you're understanding what he was doing and the way he worked and the way he had his hands and everything, then it begins to make it's more believable what maybe perhaps happened with Titanic. Then it's more believable to see, okay, if he's being able to institute this and instigate these powerful things that he had to, and that we're still living in it, that he really had to think these things out. He really had to pull some stuff off. And the hardest part about getting that Federal Reserve going was there was back at those times a 25-year limit where you could have that banking thing in place. So they were just saying, well, we'll only do it for 25 years. And then it's, the book gets into showing like there was a very big panic and a run on the bank early on, way before the 1930s, there already were crashes. And
well, he instigate the one in 1907? Wasn't he the one who started it?
Yeah, I believe that is true because he had the newspaper then and he started putting out rumors in the paper. And once people read that, I mean, you know, newspaper, we didn't have movies then are really, you know, I mean, it was the newspaper was the thing, you know, see people, they believed what they read, unfortunately. And so Morgan is so brilliant in putting that together. So it wasn't just the newspaper, but I believe that, yeah, he did this certain setting up of having the bank crash of 07 happen. And then you cause the problem and you come in with the solution, you know, he did that. So I'll figure it out for you. So, hey, this is just a temporary measure. We'll put this Federal Reserve in. And he met with the president and then he had Senator Aldrich working for him. So it wasn't just that he sort of didn't look like he was involved, but he was saying, well, I'll put the money up and I'll do this. And, you know, he's just had plan after plan after plan, but he knew if he got that thing in there working with Paul Warburg, he knew if he got that Federal Reserve bill in there, they could make it stronger and stronger and stronger and add time to it too. He knew they'd never get rid of it. And right now today, I mean, we're living in that fact. So this guy's brilliance, we have to understand what he did. It's not just like Janet Yellen's running around and, you know, or these people that, you know, the head, you know, they're following orders and such, but to have something last that long, that is amazing. We, you know, a century of this, I mean, get that in our mind. This is a century we're living in. You know, what else do we have that's a century old? I mean, that we wouldn't call a relic.
Right.
around in a Model T anymore. I mean, those are like collector's items or something. Mm-hmm. And how does that thing still be there? And I love G. Edwards Griffin's book, you know, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And it gets into the long, you know, it goes a long, long, long period up to the, I think up to the 90s and really shows.
Right. In fact, he's got an edition now that that goes, I think his fifth edition, it goes through 2008.
Yeah.
So he's got quite a history there. But you're right. I mean, this is a 100-year event, over a 100-year event. And look at how much debt we owe. I mean, we have collectively, the American people, if you add our long-term liabilities and short-term liabilities and all of our debt, it is mind-boggling. It's like almost $200 trillion when you add all these things together. That's amazing. And now they're doing more of it. They're, you know, they with the COVID-19 thing, we've created another $6 trillion just off COVID-19. They're making this thing into the biggest money maker. And at the same time, what they're doing is setting us up for their 100% digital currency and setting us up for having to have IDs, like maybe be chipped or something that allows us to buy and sell. And this is straight out of the Revelation, straight out of the Bible.
And they're also mentioning, too, that you'll be doing all your banking by your phone. So obviously you're tracked everywhere you go.
Right.
And every piece of information you plug in, they will know. Mm-hmm. And then like your banking account, they could go, well, you know, Dan, you've been a bad boy. We don't mm-hmm. like that you've been buying those guns and that ammunition. We'll just help you out there. We'll just sort of take some money out of your bank and you won't be able to buy anything. And that's really frightening. Mm-hmm. And one other thing we somewhat discussed on our show with the Black Start and the grid and everything, I had somebody, you know, I get a lot of people that want to chat with me about things, but one thought came up, I'll call it a thought, that the central bank, they would come up with a CBDC, so a central bank digital currency. And it's interesting. It's like right out there, they're just going, central bank. They didn't call it a Federal Reserve digital dollar. You noticed? It was mm-hmm. a central bank. So right back then, they're just like out in the open. Yeah, we're just a central bank now. And so what was leading up to Black Start was that possibly to instigate that, they might take the grid down themselves, which is a horrific thought, but it's easy to do. And then when the grid came back up, we would all of a sudden be into this digital thing and right. be glad of it because, oh, we're now getting assistance and something. And we, you know, just come from a pandemic and then going into a blackout pandemic, we'd be so dang glad when that power came back on. Look at Texans right now. So I'm just saying, I'm not saying any of this would happen or not. I'm saying think, people yeah. think, because if we don't at least have the intelligence and the information and then connect the dots, then we could be sitting ducks for if something like that happened. Do you have the preparation? I mean, nobody wants to go to the bank and see, boom, your money's gone all of a sudden.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened if that scenario played out. So there are many scenarios that could play out. And I just think we need to be prepared for, you can't prepare for everything, but you know, it's our job to protect our families. So you do mm-hmm. that in the society that you're in, you do the best job of that. And I feel so many people are so just watching TV and reading the news and watching the news and believing the news. They think that is the mind frame. And so they're not really doing the steps that a show like yours might say, hey, these are the steps to do. Think out of the box a little bit. It's not like going it's going to cost you more. It's just a different way of protecting your finances and protecting your assets.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a matter of fact, we've talked about this off air, and I think this country is the most ill-prepared that we've ever been in any time in our history as a nation. And so many people, like you're talking about, so many people that they just don't have a clue. They just sit in front of the one-eyed mind sucker and watch whatever comes out, and they believe every second of it. And we have that. We see that even in our own families. You know, they believe this nonsense. And what we need to do is we need to make people wake up to the reality is, if you don't do it for yourself, we've talked about this on air with Thumper, with different radio programs that we're doing, different podcasts. But I believe that all this talk about all these things that are going to happen, you know, we hear about, well, this is going to happen with Trump on such and such a date, and this is going to happen. I don't believe any of them. I think we actually need to prepare ourselves for any circumstance. And if we don't do it, I don't think it's going to get done. It's just that simple.
I think you're correct. And, back to the TV, I would say addicted to TV, and it's as entertainment and even the news and all of that. So it's subliminal. So even if people aren't trying to set out to believe it, they do end up wasting time being entertained by it, which is just as frightening as believing it, because then they're not doing the things that they would need. And TV is made to do that. It's made to give you, you know, like sound bites. Now you're not getting a whole story, but there's a mind frame. I mean, and I make films, so I know that if you have a certain amount of information flashing, the mind needs to know what's happening next. Even if it's a crummy thing, you have to finish the sentence. We have to know what was going to be said. Well, we hang on that edge. And, so they use that in the news and in the and they're very guarded about what films are out there. Films that are controversial are hard to get out, and they're really easier to get out in a format like yours. So I think you have to. It's not like we can say people have to do anything, because really people have the choice not to do anything. But it's not like we need 100% of the people to. Join or whatever, or to be aware. As we know with the American Revolution, it was a small amount of people who gave us the luxury and fought and stood out there on their morals to say, we want to have a country where we can prosper, have liberty, and have our freedom. And if everybody really took that to heart and was at least trying to salvage that, we'd be so much better off. And I think that's the thing that's slipping away, is our morals aren't really, they're not really given to us every day.
Right.
I mean, even in churches, it's not like, think about your freedom and liberty and stuff. It's, you know, it's about, you know, God and Jesus and I think churches actually could be more powerful to get people on to the thought of thinking about, you know, you need to take care of your family. That's God gives you that, you know, gives you the strength of the man and the woman and the children and that format. And, you know, that's our responsibility, is our family. And
absolutely. Right now, well, you mentioned the church in that, and we've done a number of programs. You know, the Black Robe Regiment was really behind much of the military aspect of the American Revolution. The pastors of the churches were many times the head of the military units that were fighting in the Revolutionary War. And we've lost that. And we lost that when we became 501c3 corporations, and you were not allowed to talk about anything political in the church, or you might lose your tax exemption. Since when do taxes when is that part of the church? I mean, it's just ridiculous how we've allowed our churches to be bought out by the other side.
Yeah, and the corporations that we're supporting as well. Mm-hmm. We don't realize it, but in some respects, we're supporting the heck out of China with all the things that we buy here. We don't even notice, are they made here in America? And that's a real big problem because, you know, it leads us to not manufacturing things here. When we get into a tight bind, we won't be able to lay our hands on stuff.
Right.
Good one, but we still need the technology. If all of a sudden things were cut off, are you going to be able to get a cell phone? Because how much of this is manufactured somewhere else? So,
We were talking about the technology, the cell phone technology. Thumper was talking about this. Do you know that there's a digital matrix that's built into the technology in your phone where it can actually measure the room that you're in, and it can identify all the things that are in that room and where the windows are, where the doors are, everything else? I mean,
wow.
That's absolutely frightening when you think about it. It's just amazing that we've allowed ourselves to have these kind of spying operations in our home. And it's like this computer. I mean, yeah, it's great. We're being able to do this podcast so that people all over the world can see what you're doing. But at the same time, people all over the world can see what you're doing.
And they can see, they can see like by body temperature, like how many people are in the room. I mean, it's frightening. And so those are the things that would be great if people could say, hey, you know, I want a phone, but I don't want these things in my phone. And we're just offered the phone and that's it. And you're sort of offered the computer. You don't get to say, like, do I want spyware out of it? But yet, like the military, when they're ordering things, you darn know their phones. Hey, I don't want to be tracked. I don't want people, you know, knowing any of this stuff. You have to have the military stuff be very secure. So there's no reason that our phones, it's a very premeditated move to make what you're talking about in these, phones.
Appliances.
So, I mean, if we don't, as people put a halt to some of this stuff somehow, it's not going to be so pretty. And really, we're by not understanding it, by not connecting the dots yourself, and that's why it's so nice. If you know, I say don't take my word for it, do your own research, because that way you really involved yourself. It's easy just to go and repeat, oh yeah, this happened, and that's just being a parrot, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of men that I really respect, and they do research on their own. And there's a lot of women too, I should say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to search out this information for yourself and see, and then you can be part of the solution. You can help other people if you really get it. You know, I don't want to be spouting false information, but what I spout is look at what could have happened. Look at what, you know, look at the scenarios. Try to figure it out. Like they do in the military, they do certain things where they play, you know, games and such. You know, we don't have to take it that far, but for our own protection, to understand, to protect our banking and our food and having enough water if some situation happens, or just not being ripped off for your pension by, you know, just trusting in this system that we see is made to make certain factions of it very beyond wealthy. It's control. It's beyond wealth. I have wealth, but I don't have that controlling power. These people are beyond, you know, they are like a country in themselves. They are so powerful, so much financial backing. It's incredible.
It is. It is. They own and control entire countries. And when they own and control something as big as the United States, that's pretty darn scary in itself. You know, your comments about all this stuff, I'll tell you what, I'm so tickled to get to know you, because we have a group of friends, as it were, that seem to, I don't know, if we work together, if we share our ideas, if we learn to work together in ways that we can promote each other so that our ideas get more traction around the world. That's exactly what we need to be doing, because it's like the program we did on Sunday. Now, I think Randy Pinocchi and you are going to probably be working together on some legislative bills. I've got a feeling that Randy will be trying to pull some other public service commissioners around the country into that same thing. And your film is so powerful. What a great tool. If you could take that film to every legislator in the country and have them watch that film, do you think our electrical grid would be in the kind of shape it is right now? I don't think so. So that's the power of people like you that do the kind of work that you do.
Well, I thank you so much. And it was just interesting in Texas, since we're on this subject now, the head of the commissioner there was asked to resign. And now she's kind of come forward and said, hey, like, these people have known about this for over 10 years. So she's what I wouldn't quite call her a whistleblower now, but you know, what they do with these commissioners is they'll put a new one in now, and that one will start all over again, looking at the problem.
Right.
When our commissioner here, John Wellinghoff, I'm in California, started to look at our grid situation, all of a sudden he had to resign. And he had known enough about it that he could become a whistleblower. But when they put the new person in, that new person, they give him a clean slate. So it's like, okay, you got to start all over again. So it'll take about 5 years for them to get enough where they go, okay, I've really researched it and I'm ready to do something. And then they make them resign.
Yeah.
It starts all over again. And so it's this is why I just want people to, like, just look with Titanic and Olympic. I mean, does that make any sense that Olympic could run for 25 years at full speed, being with bracing struts? I mean, a list. I mean, it doesn't. Does it make any sense why these commissioners, once they get to a certain point, maybe even want to do something, they have to resign? And as she said, they know about this. They've known it for 10 years. They've known about these issues. Mm-hmm. And I know Senator Bob Hall in Texas is working really hard to get the grid protected. And here you see Texas, like this huge state, is just devastated, down on her knees.
Well, the thing that happened in Texas, too, is they not only did that chairman of the commission resign, but there were five others that resigned as well. And what it boiled down to is, as soon as they were accountable, all of a sudden then they resign. Mm-hmm. And because they don't like the pressure of being told that they did a lousy job. Well, you know, the truth of that, and we're getting into another area, but the truth of that is that it isn't really that the grid was bad as much as the ideas that drove the grid were bad. And they started shutting down coal-fired plants. They shut down three of them that were perfectly good plants, but they completely, when they shut them down, they don't just shut them down and lock the doors. They decommission them so they can't be used again. And in this scenario, they were depending on 25% of their electricity is dependent now on green energy. And the green energy was completely useless. It couldn't do anything. The wind turbines couldn't turn, and the photovoltaics wouldn't work because they had snow and ice on the photocells. So, you know, there's a collection of really, really bad ideas that drive all this stuff, and they always try to blame it on something else. They don't blame it on what caused the problem. And we saw the thing out of the White House. The White House saying, well, it wasn't green energy that failed, it was gas and coal. Well, that's not true. It just is not true. What failed was the fact that they were trying to rely so much on the backup systems to provide all the energy, because the part that the green part wasn't doing anything, that it ended up overtaxing the whole system, and the whole system ended up going down.
And that's just, you know, through a mechanical weather failure. We're not even talking about if somebody was to do the cyber threat and actually intentionally take the grid down. So, yeah, I urge everybody, that's the film Black Start. You could find that on my website at heartfeltfilms.net. It's a fascinating subject. And again, that's something that, you know, people don't understand that they can lose their savings, their bank account real quick. And we could really be in dire straits. And it's so easy to take the grid down. The grid is huge now. We really rely on it. And these energy companies, I just, you know, they're really out for themselves making a profit. And when I was speaking with Randy, I'm saying that they want to look like they just go, hey, all we have to do is be reliable, give you a fair pricing, and, you know, make sure that you get good service. We aren't getting those things, and they love to go in and, you know, cause like where they can turn a station down so they can charge more money by importing. I mean, they have all kinds of ways to get your buck out of here that the energy companies are doing that are very underhanded. So again, you want to connect the dots and understand what they're doing. Our energy should not be as expensive as it is at all. As a matter of fact, if we put the protections in for the grid to protect it from cyber malware, from any kind of an EMP, or from even the solar storms that come in and cause great amounts of havoc with the energy grid right now, because our energy grid is so big, it's attracting the sun's magnetic forces to it much easier. We already have proven we have billions and billions of dollars of worth of damage that's done to equipment that they have to keep repairing all the time. Not enough to knock the grid out so far. We've been, thank God, lucky enough that we haven't been hit with the big solar storm to do that, but we're always hit with small ones. And they just want the control, and they're not fixing the problem. I guess I could relate it to like maybe the medical industry. It's like, isn't it more profitable if we don't cure the disease? We just keep giving people the medicine
right
that we need them to buy every year, every day, every week, every month. We know that's a bigger profit than if we just go, hey, it's all cured, and now we don't have that problem anymore. That's a lot of money that somebody's not getting in their pocket. If you look at the energy industry, it's the same way. If they don't have certain power fails, then they can't go, oh, we had a power fail, we have to charge you more, or different, you know, scenarios. So these are the things that, just look into this stuff for yourself, save yourself some money, and understand it. We'd all be saving a great amount if we had a better, safer grid. And I'd sleep better at night, not thinking that some other country or a rogue nation or for some purposes somebody would take the grid down. It's very easy to do. Very easy to do. It's frightening how simple it would be. And those protections are not in place. And so that's
Well, Peter Pry mentioned that to me, that we've tried to come up with a number, and he actually felt that the grid could be extremely well protected for somewhere around $10 billion.
Yeah, and if they'd have done it 5 years ago, it would have been $3 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and yeah. the costs will keep going up the longer we wait. But there's people out there, brilliant people that have all kinds of ingenious grid protection systems, and they're ready to go in place. But it's, you know, we're barking up against a big system that just doesn't want to let any control out of their hands. So.
Right.
And they do buy a lot of the politicians. And so that comes back again to J.P. Morgan and Titanic. I mean, he bought up the politicians that sat on the hearing that said what was Titanic actually sunk and all these things. They had to have a hearing. And well, he bought a senator, happened to have been named Smith, Senator Smith. And so of course, you know, of course it was an act of God. So they didn't really look farther into that, you know, and they didn't listen to the women. And the women were very interesting because they were this very elite group of women who every year they would get on Titanic or a ship like Titanic, and they would go to France. It was the thing. And it was really when you started having a lot of these women wanted to have like apartments and these fancy apartments in America. So they had like this thing, and then they were inventing vacations. And then a lot of the women, as you saw, even in Cameron's movie, like they were starting to collect art to bring back to their apartments. And so they'd go to France and they'd try to outdo each other, and they'd stay at these wonderful spas and all the fancy hotels and everything. And then they have these lovely places in New York. And so, you know, it's just very fashionable and taking advantage of these situations and things. And, you know, life is something that we have to really think about it differently, because people can pull things that you just don't see happening. And for these women to not have been listened to, it was real tragedy. They were just told to shut up, especially even John Astor's wife. She was, because she was so young, it was really easy to shut her up. And the family was so powerful. And they didn't want her to get all Astor's money, since he was one of the wealthiest men in the world. So they just didn't want her talking about it. We heard the vibration on the ship.
Right.
We heard the explosion. We saw the ship break into a different way than we normally see it breaking, like this instead of like that. So I thought that was a really interesting theory, that one of the seamen had drawn that picture, and the other women were saying that's what it, you know, went in this different shape. And so so many things that it was very tough for women to be heard at that time, but they all had been taking that voyage. They knew what a ship should feel like. And they knew that vibrating, they wanted to go and talk to the captain, what's going on. And then Smith was going to say, oh, well, like it's a new ship, we're running the engines. And so she's vibrating. He had to have an excuse ready to kind of quell their fears, but they were knowledgeable. So, you know, it was really a sad thing that they weren't listened to, because they really could have put a lot more facts together. And sadly, they've all passed away. But Eva Hart did say, I know I saw that ship breaking too. And it's so interesting. I mean, just if nothing else, the historical record that was done at the time said she went down in one piece. Titanic went down in one piece. And
yeah.
No, that's not true. So, you know, give some, that's why I, you know, it's so important that we see things for ourselves and think for ourselves. So, you know,
well, I have to tell you, I'm very intrigued, and I can't wait to see some of your other work. That American Empire, An Act of Collective Madness, I need to get on your site and pull down that film. Now, it is available on your site.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And it's a real connecting the dot film. So I think, Dan, you would love it. And, you know, puts in perspective, like, you know, how the John and Alan Dulles were really responsible for giving us the education system that we had. One of the Dulles brothers said, I'm going to just focus on what we want people to know in school and learn. And the other one was focusing on, this is how we're going to do, we're not going to do anything in the medical industry that doesn't profit. We're not going for herbs and healing with juicing and carrots or marijuana or any of that stuff. It's got to be something. And we're going to, and all the doctors have to take this oath and they have to come up through this way. And, you know, right. It's been very profitable. And geez, you know, like, that's...
And look at it. Look what it's done. I mean, our medical industry right now, and I know that that was the Rockefeller family were very involved in that too, John D., because he owned Standard Oil, which was the biggest oil producer in the world at the time. And guess what? All these pharmaceuticals were an offshoot of petrochemicals. Uh-huh. And that's how pharmaceuticals got going. And he had
and
such
the food industry too. That so they wanted to own the food industry, and that's why we have the agriculture. It's so fascinating how it fits together from the education to the banking system to the medical to the whole food and giant ag. They couldn't control it if we had like all of the small farmers that we had. That's when we had control and we had real security. Like if there was an earthquake here where I am or bad fires or something like that, I still could pretty much go left, right, forward or backward, east, west, south, north, and find within walking distance somebody growing a farm, you know, 150 years ago.
Right.
100 years ago. Now, if anything happens, there isn't anything growing here. We don't even have water supply if that would end up stopping. So we've really set ourselves up by the convenience of having everything trucked in and flown in. And I will tell you, in Europe, they have faced a war. They've been through World War I, World War II. If you go to Europe, you see a lot more food in close proximity because they know, like, we do not want to be starved out. We've already done that. And it's very painful. So their food is really a lot closer, a lot riper, a lot, it's like their food there is really great. So here we agriculturally pick our things before it's too ripe and they have to be all sized right so they can fit down a conveyor belt and they have to pick them so they're harder so that the conveyor belt doesn't bruise them. And so the food quality, you know, it's just... It's lacking. It's lacking in the way they grow with a lot of GMO stuff now. It's very sad what's happened to our food supply, and people should at least understand what they're eating. Even on the, it should, you know, we get a little bit more now where it says GMO on it. But if you're going to be eating something that's genetically modified with organisms in it that have been tampered with from their natural ability, you want to know that because it does things to your gut flora, to your gut system, and you know, we've seen, since we've gone to big agriculture, we've seen a lot more weird diseases, allergies, you know.
You've done your research, I can tell.
Yeah, and thank you. But we're it's a fascinating impressed. Film. It's really a fascinating film. And G. Edward Griffin is in it. And I think it's one of the best films out there to connect the dots. And that's why Oliver Stone said, wow. You know, I met with him and he goes, oh, I want to see this movie. So he did. And I was thrilled to get that nice endorsement from him.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring something up. You mentioned food and GMO, but I'm going to mention something. Do you know that the American Planting Association was really created? It was modeled after the Soviet planting system, and that the Rockefeller Brothers Trust were the ones that funded the initial funding that got the American Planting Association going in the United States in the mid-50s, late-50s, and that look now at how many communities you cannot even grow a garden in your backyard. You cannot do that. Very, very few communities can you actually have a garden in your backyard. They have eliminated the greatest source of food independence in the world. Everybody used to have a garden and that can or they'd do whatever they needed to out of their own garden. You can't even have a garden in most communities now.
And people don't even really, a lot of people now, I'd say the majority, don't have the space to do it, don't have the knowledge. So that's a, mm-hmm. It's a knowledge that's getting lost. We had a 14-acre farm here in South Central, and we had wasn't part of it, but Daryl Hannah was like really, and a lot of the actors were in defense of keeping it because there was a threat to tear it down. And it was feeding all these people, 14 acres. It was amazing how much food, and it had been going for quite a long time, had, you know, avocado trees and lemon trees. And they just came in and did the 7-tier gardening. So it was just massively growing root food and vine food and trees. So all the kids would go there in the afternoon. So instead of being in gangs, they'd go there and, you know, grow some food. So they had some food to eat because the other only food that was available was 7-Eleven, the liquor store. And what can you buy there that's healthy? You know, some Ding Dongs or some, you know, whatever, and junk food and candy and sodas and things. So this was a big deal. And these people, they went there every day and tended that and were giving food out because you grow enough, you share with everybody. It was amazing. And they came and they tore that down. The whoever there is, the county or somehow said, okay, we got to get rid of that. And I think it was really like the big markets didn't want the competition. Mm-hmm. And whatever the underlying causes, it was taken down. And probably you would, you know what I'm talking about. I don't want to get kicked off the radio, but when people are not allowed to grow food for themselves, it's a serious thing. And one of the things Thomas Jefferson did in his presidency was he went to everywhere he could, all the countries, and gathered all the seeds that he could get and brought them to America and gave them to the farmers and said, be prosperous. And I want you to grow all this stuff. So he gave every kind of seed, every, you know, out of his, I'm not even sure, but it might have been out of his own pocket. I'm sure it was out of his own brilliance to do that. Mm-hmm. And our country prospered because of it. So to lose that luxury and not even know, we just don't even know. Oh, we just go to the store now. Like kids think things just grow in the store. They just come off the tree box. They don't even think. And that's what I go back to connecting the dots. I love your show. I think that's so important if people start connecting the dots and, you know, get the schools to grow foods. I've been in schools in Washington where they were saying, hey, let's start teaching the kids gardening here. There are things that can be done. It's just that people have to know what they are and think about it and not lose that ability, because we lose the ability to have food and to grow it locally and to have water locally and to know how to get water locally and to know how to, you know, save the water that you have.
It'll end up like Texas, Petraea. It'll end up like Texas.
Worse.
I hate to say this, but we're out of time. We always end up running out of time. But I want you to have a chance to talk a little bit about your website and how people can go to your website.
Well, it's, again, www.heartfeltfilms.net. It's got everything that I do on there. And well, there's a few things that aren't on there, but we're looking to make this film that you just saw today, our Titanic film. We'd love to make that a feature movie. Mm-hmm. That would just be our big goal. And to also make the 10 Days at Jekyll Island. We'd love to make that. So we're looking for funding at this point, because there are two great films that were just you know, I look at Oliver Stone's JFK, and it was such a powerful film. I really love that. And doing 10 Days at Jekyll Island would be sort of that kind of a film where you're, you know, doing kind of a nice expose on, hey, you know, this is how it could have happened. And it like kind of, there's some plausible sense there to it. And,
I'm going to make a suggestion when you do that. Do that with showing how Jekyll Island actually created the Federal Reserve System, and then go further into how they are planning to create a digital society where every every transaction is controlled digitally, and we no longer have any control over our own financial system. That would be a fantastic program to really lean into.
Yeah. So as we know, the films are expensive to make, so we're looking for our funding. But I think these are great topics. You know, there's so much truth that is more out wild than fiction. And I love delving into that. You know, I mean, I can make stories up if you want, but somebody else is doing that. There's enough of those and they're great and they're fun.
Right.
But I like things that are, you know, make people really think and, you know, they're fascinating. It's fascinating what happened with the Federal Reserve. The story of the people that were able to do it is fascinating when you see all the intricate things they had to do. They couldn't just walk into Congress and fool people. There were a lot of sharp people that said, no, that's not happening. So it was when you see how the plan is laid out, it's just, it's an intriguing plot. So it's beautiful. And so, yeah, I would just hope people, the book is there. So you can go read the book right now. You don't need to wait for the film. 10 Days at Jekyll Island on my website, heartfeltfilms.net.
And we're putting that link out on the in our live chat. So they're getting that link. And I'm sure a lot of them will show up there.
Yeah, I've got a feeling you're going to. We are out of time. I see that our program is out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Petrea. And I want to say, I think if you're interested, I've got a feeling you're going to be a frequent guest to come back on and help us connect dots.
I love your show, Connect the Dots. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. But we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence.